All right. Hey there, this is Bram Kanstein and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. In this episode, I'm joined by Tuur de Meester. Tuur is a prominent Bitcoin investor, economist, and early adopter who's been involved with Bitcoin since 2011. He's the founder of the Bitcoin investment fund Adamant Capital and has been a longtime proponent of Bitcoin as a sound and auditable form of money. Tuur has been one of my most influential researchers and educators in understanding Bitcoin. So I'm super grateful and excited to talk with him today. Welcome, man.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Bram.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, like I mentioned, like first off, I really want to say like you're one of the people whose work has been like super influential in my understanding of Bitcoin and especially like the economic implications, the philosophy part, Austrian economics, like all of that is not my background. And yeah, you're one of the people that I learned a lot from. So I want to thank you for that because like I know how nice it is to hear that. But like you, when you do stuff on the internet, like you don't know how far it travels, right?
So I think you are absolutely right. You have no idea. Yeah. And of course, yeah, it's so cool to hear it. And at the same time, it feels right because there's been people that I've learned so much from, and this is just a way to pay it forward.
Yeah, exactly. I think you would agree that once you understand Bitcoin and you talk about it, it feels like an altruistic motivation compared to what the critics might say that we are pumping our bags.
Right? Pumping our bags. Yeah. I mean, in some way, I feel like oftentimes it's also just a way to deal with our own insecurities about this. Like you just have to study it because it's so different and it's... And so in order to feel comfortable having a lot of your future, like your literal personal future invested in it, yeah, it requires a lot of study. And then it just helps to talk and share thoughts and discuss.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So before we really jump in, I heard before like you discovered Bitcoin while you were traveling in Argentina. What was it that you saw and what drew you in?
Yeah, I mean, it helped, of course, that I was already afraid of what's happening in Europe. And we had the first wave of bailouts in 2008-09. And the banks were just teetering, really. Like Belgium has very big banks and it's a small country. So I was already scared and trying to find answers. And so that background really helped to then, you know, visit my friends and see that they're mining Bitcoin and learning about it and seeing also how easy it was for them to move money in and out of the country, even though it was on financial lockdown. Like Cristina Kirchner was very harsh on capital controls and things like that. So it really was almost a perfect environment to learn about it. And my friends there were very educated about it. So it really helped to set the tone and give me motivation to dive in deeper.
Yeah. And so it took a little time, but eventually, I think just a few months, you recommended it to people who followed your newsletter, right? I think Bitcoin was like $5.
I think I took about what was the most 6 months or something. I think I first learned about it like in spring 2011. And then the newsletter only launched, I believe, the first edition was maybe August or September of that year. And I was very nervous because I had never owned a stock before in my life. And then here I was going to recommend people to buy stocks and pretend that I knew what I was talking about. So it was, there was also some hesitation to come out and go full blast, talk about Bitcoin to this, completely new audience. But also for myself, I needed some time to digest it more and talk to more people. So I think I first wrote about it later in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was the biggest thing? Like it looks like you got it, right? Pretty quick. You know, I think a lot of people talk about that. It takes some time to learn certain things or unlearn certain things. So I was wondering if there were like any specific things that you ran into or was it pretty clear cut?
No, the thing that worried me was counterfeiting. Was can't people just make more of it? It's digital. Like how come you can't just make more of it? And so then that's why it was so helpful to talk to a few engineers early on to really get an education on how Bitcoin works specifically. But even then, even so, I was still hedging for quite a while. I was talking about cryptocurrencies, and I said that Bitcoin is the most prominent one for the moment, and you know, maybe some others would come out. But yeah, that counterfeiting thing was big. And then if I had these, of course, we all have the same doubts come up over time, like, oh, well, can't they hard fork it? What about the miners? Can't they attack it? Like you know, you just go through the worries. And but of course, on Bitcoin Talk back then, the forums, that was the most important online venue to discuss Bitcoin, bitcointalk.org. Because it was so non-commercial, it was practically all engineers who were talking. So the level of conversation was very high, and the level of people with ulterior motives and scammers was very low. So in some way, it was a special environment to do research in. And from the economic sense, there was not a lot of understanding about where this could go. And so, you know, like a lot of engineers who are focused on security tend to have this pessimistic mindset, and that makes them so good. They're constantly paranoid about what could go wrong. And so I had several developers, Bitcoin developers, stress to me, like, hey, this is a beta product. Bitcoin is in beta. You can't just recommend. I mean, they didn't give me advice on what to do, but you could feel their hesitation about, like, oh, you're going to talk about this like an investment? Like it's we're just testing here. You know, so the challenge was more on the economic side.
And so from those early days till now, how do you think, what has been the biggest shift in your perspective over 11 years, like on Bitcoin?
It just gradually learning and believing more and more that Bitcoin is a lever that can lift the world, like that can really change everything. It just there's so many implications. And of course, then you also start to think about the implications of the introduction of fiat money and how that has changed everything. It really is quite incredible. So the realization that there is a cultural shift going on here, and that has been it just it's it, 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 it there's so many things that are affected by it that you just can't wrap your head around it in 6 months or in a year, I don't think. Not that I feel like I see it, right? I mean, maybe there's blind spots that I have or survivor's bias because Bitcoin has been so good to me. Maybe I'm overlooking some serious issues with it.
Hey there, I want to ask you for a quick favor. I noticed something interesting. 75% of my viewers aren't subscribed yet. Subscribing helps me grow this channel, ensuring more great content each week. So, if you're enjoying our conversations on Bitcoin for Millennials, please consider hitting the subscribe button on YouTube or the follow button on your favorite podcasting app. I'm super grateful for everyone who already joined and shared their thoughts. Your feedback really keeps me going, and I want to ask you to continue doing that. I try to respond to all the comments and also the emails that I get and DMs on Twitter, etc. So, don't stop doing that. I'll keep going. Now, let's get back to the conversation. I like that you said believing. You know, I think the believing comes from the research and the scrutiny and the verification you can do yourself, right? And like, I know that and you know that, but when people hear that you believe in it, right? Like, from a fiat world point of view, that sounds like more ideological, right? Or someone else told you and now you believe it, you know? So I think it's interesting you said the word to leave. Like, I believe the same, but it has a different meaning now, at least, you know, with regards to Bitcoin. So do you feel like you're a different person because of it?
I mean, it has helped me lean into a real optimism about the future. I do think things are going to get a lot worse economically than before they get better. But I do believe that once we hit the bottom, we are going to be able to rebuild for real the the world economy. And of course, some countries, some people are not going to want to play ball. They're not going to want to go along. They're going to want to stay in the inflationary mindset, and their economies will not recover. But we can absolutely work with people who want to. And yeah, it has made me a lot more optimistic. And because what I feared was that we were going to go into perpetual hyperinflationary cycles, like every 10 years, a wipeout event. And then you can just never build up capital stock in the economy, which then you get countries that look like the developing countries in Latin America, you know, and also Africa and places like that, where there's just constantly inflation raging. And people need to be able to save before they have enough confidence and low time preference and comfort to build the factories, the buildings, the cultural institutions that will have longevity and that can make life better for everyone, right? But if every time you're being stolen from, then all you care about, obviously, is just, you know, trying to survive and feeding your family, and you don't think about the long term because you can't.
Yeah, it's going from consuming to building, right? Well, I think what Save Dean says about high time preference, not even consciously, right? People are forced to have
exactly
a high time preference. So what do you see as kind of like key threats or challenges for, you know, more growth and adoption?
Yeah, for Bitcoin. Well, we talked about faith. I think the threat is for people to lose faith, and for people to think that the values, the cypherpunk values, are not strong enough or not important enough to keep defending. And you do that by running full nodes, by contributing to the Bitcoin ecosystem, by holding Bitcoin. You know, even if you just own some Bitcoin and you don't do anything else, you are contributing, because you are basically signaling to the world that the Bitcoin needs to have a certain value, and you are contributing to keeping that a fact. And there is going to be a lot of fear mongering the next in this cycle, probably, and the next bear market, probably even more. I do feel like we are now going to see governments actively resisting Bitcoin adoption, like trying to slow it down, trying to boycott, trying to paint Bitcoin adoption as, you know, Bitcoin as a technology as something that perhaps creates inflation. Like, believe it or not, I believe they're going to use Bitcoin to blame the inflation on, and say that, oh, you guys are self-promoting all the time and you're sucking the value out of the dollar and the euro, and that's destabilizing everything. And also, they're going to say that Bitcoin is used for terrorism, and all these criminals are using it. So it's basically the counter-reformation. You know, Bitcoin is like that push for, you know, breaking the shackles between the government and the money. That is what Bitcoin is. And the government is going to say, no, we want to keep it that way. Not all governments. Some of them, of course, are going to embrace Bitcoin. But so, yeah, it's very challenging, because it basically means that you are a heretic. You know, if you embrace Bitcoin, you are going to be seen as somebody who is a nonconformist and is potentially a volatile element in society. And so in certain countries, you'll be less welcome. Like, you will be, you know, life will be a bit more difficult for you. And of course, we're going to do everything we can to make the experience of a Bitcoiner as good as possible, meaning that you can hold Bitcoin in a discreet way. You can, it can always be in your possession, no matter where you live. But it's a mental challenge, you know, and it's kind of a moral test as well. Like, how much are you willing to put on the line to invest in this kind of future? And I'm absolutely not judging people who want to be more careful, depending on the countries they live in. You know, absolutely not. But I just think that, you know, to answer your question, that I think is the biggest challenge, that we are now in a stage where Bitcoin is going to go from 1 trillion to 10, 50, 100 trillion. And then, you know, 1 trillion is only less than a percent of the global wealth. But once you start talking about 50 trillion, well, then that's 10% of global wealth. And a lot of the global wealth is actually a bubble. So maybe the real global wealth is only 200 trillion instead of 500, you know, once the bubble shrinks. So yeah, once we start talking about $50 trillion Bitcoin, then you could be talking about 25% of global wealth all of a sudden is invested in Bitcoin. So similar, you know, to what we saw in the Netherlands and in Flanders with the merchant class, who became very, very wealthy because they embraced global trade and they embraced freedom of religion. Of course, it was a threat to the status quo, and it's a quite, I believe, a quite monumental shift in the culture of the world. And the difference, yeah, of course, is that it's less geographically bounded, right? So if you can adopt Bitcoin no matter where you live, if you do it discreetly, you could probably have Bitcoin even while living in North Korea. So that is different compared to previous technological revolutions.
Yeah. Would you say that, I don't want to, the word is harsh, but I don't know another word, but it feels like a war in a sense. Like, mm-hmm, either it's a war of power in a sense, it's a philosophical war in a sense, you know, the power to the people kind of thing. Is that something you think people who are new to this should understand?
It's actually a word I want to be using, likely I will be using in my presentation in Prague, coming up the conference there next month, because it's so interesting. The world war, literally WAR, comes from Indo-European verra, which originally meant chaos and confusion. And it's still, you see it in Dutch, right? To be in de war means I am confused. And so we don't need for bullets to be flying or bombs to be dropping to be in a war-like environment. I believe we're already there, definitely in Europe and in other places. There is so much confusion about what is really happening. And of course, the reality is, in many ways, we have been subject to Ponzi schemes, social security, fractional reserve banking, all those things. Basically, there's a lot of empty promises, and there will come a time when the music stops. Like, it's the musical chairs game, and a lot of people are going to realize there's not enough chairs to sit on. And then that's usually when when people get into the streets and there's more protests, and then you can have civil war, or eventually governments feel like they have to find an enemy outside of the country, so they start blaming minorities or outside countries, and then you can have, you know, the classical warfare. And to an extent, it's already happening, this civil unrest, of course, because of the inflation. You know, that is already a way that the Ponzi scheme is starting to really, the pain is being felt. That's the inflation. People are saying, like, I'm doing the same type of work. I am a nurse, I am a blue collar worker, I'm a dentist, whatever. And yet I can no longer pay the bills. Like, what's going on? You know, yeah, I mean, I think a war is a good word, definitely a good word to explore about what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I am thinking about what you just said about the threats. I'm going to look up a tweet while I'm talking. You know, the gaslighting that we're going to see that we're already seeing is off the charts. Right. I saw the Dutch National Bank, April 7, they said higher loans are fueling inflation. And today they said, again, Dutch National Bank, high inflation. April 7, they said higher loans do not fuel inflation. And today they said higher inflation is due to higher loans. You know, so if they don't even
I think Madeleine Vos tweeted that, right?
Oh, yeah. Also, there were some Dutch people, yeah.
I see.
But
yeah,
I mean, like,
no, absolutely, absolutely.
They don't understand. How can you, you know, like, or well, they pretend, you know.
Well, so what happens in this situation of war, of people, of confusion, and it really goes very deep. I think people already sense basically that something is off. And they feel threatened. They feel like their livelihood is threatened. Their future is threatened. They don't know if they will get a pension or not, even though it's still too early for them to really say it out loud. Even regular people, I believe, are starting to feel something is very wrong here. Something is wrong. And what you get in those kind of environments is that much more quickly, people tend to go in fight or flight. Which means their prefrontal cortex gets shut off and their reptile brain is more active. It's all about trying to get out of the moment, trying to get out of the situation, this kind of panicky feeling. And then that means that this simple gaslighting, when you and I look at these headlines, it's like it doesn't make any sense. Somehow, for a person who is close to fight or flight, it's enough. It's okay. There's a reason the experts said they don't even think about what it really means or what the reasoning is. It's enough that they have a little, it's like a popsicle. They're soothed for a little bit. And so I believe that's what we're seeing is that more and more people are starting to panic. And that's why populism is able to grow, because people don't have bandwidth to go into an in-depth discussion about what's really going on, because they feel so insecure, both emotionally and financially. They're starting to feel more and more insecure.
Yeah. Now, that's also why I said, you know, spiritual war in a sense, right? Your mind is obligated with this daily stuff, basically, and you don't, well, if you get the little popsicle taste, you know, like there's not really space to actually view this from a bit further than, you know, probably your ego that you know, gets talked to, basically. And, you know, it's, of course, very off center or not centered if you just go along with, you know, the gaslighting that has been in front of you.
I just want to add before we go to the next thing is that there's also a cycle at work, because the people who are panicking are then also, they try to prevent getting triggered again. And so they start censoring other people. They start saying like, oh, you can't say that. And so now we're seeing more and more censorship happening and silencing. But that, of course, creates more anxiety, because then you know that you cannot ask certain questions and you won't even go there, right? So there is almost like we're all being pushed into a state of delusion. Like that's, we're being encouraged to go there more and more utopian, delusional. And of course, you know, it's unsustainable, but I think that's how it works.
Yeah, I lost you for a second.
Oh, yeah. But, I'm done.
Yeah. it's kind of like the don't think for yourself, we'll take care of you or something, right? Like I just saw a video of these demonstrations on the colleges in America, and they are like, we are hungry and we are cold. You should take care of us. And it's so paradoxical when you look at that, right? It's like, I'm protesting the government, but please take care of me, right? Yes. I'm like, what, huh? You know, but they are serious, right? So we can kind of laugh about it maybe, but they really feel that and they're acting like that, right? So I think that's an illustration of what you just said. Yeah, it's fascinating to see. I feel a bit, I don't know, like helpless in a sense, like I don't know what to do about it, right? Like you're viewing it, and I think you illustrated it in a great way, but what do you think? Like, what should we do?
Well, I believe one there is some good knowledge in the world of addictions and how to deal with people who are addicted. And I do believe it's accurate to talk about people who are emotionally immature and who are both the students in your example and the government. They are both acting like emotional children, really, and they are both codependent on each other. Like the government needs the helplessness from the people, and the people need the government to tell them they cannot fix it themselves, and we are going to take care of you. So there's that destructive cycle that's happening, which is similar to if you live in a family with lots of addicts. Everybody is creating more and more chaos. And what you need to do to survive and to become healthy is to create distance between yourself and that. And it doesn't mean you have to necessarily leave the country you live in, but it does mean that you think carefully about how to expose yourself to this, and how much you can handle. And because if you get sucked into, for example, lots of political debates and things like that, I think it's crazy making, and you're more likely to actually become part of the problem because you just become so reactive, and you feel more and more helpless than if you make more distance and cultivate some compassion and hang out with people who understand where you're coming from and who are willing to have just interesting conversations in a more cool-headed way. Then it's also better. You can much better take care of yourself. And because honestly, like living a kind of a Bitcoin-oriented life is challenging. There's lots of volatility. Like people always say, oh, Bitcoin is so volatile. But really, what the volatility is just reflecting is how emotionally volatile the rest of the world is. Because if you just buy Bitcoin once and you hold it, you are not contributing to volatility, right? It's the people who are just, oh, they're jumping on the gravy train, and then they're selling and panicking, and then they're euphoric. They are creating it. So it's another way that we are already confronted with the madness of the world. So that's kind of my general thinking about this stuff, is that things are going to get worse economically, and politically. And we have to think of this, or it helps at least for me to think about this as, these are people who have a specific type of addiction. Like they are trying to avoid looking at the reality, and they're making up a lot of stories to help them do that. And it's kind of a crazy life to be living that way, but it's just where we are, and it's going to last a while.
I love what you said about the volatility, right? Like it's I was a little later than you, but also 11 years now into Bitcoin, right? Like these literally what you said, right? Like you do the work, you understand what this is, you understand its importance, you understand the implications. And I once saw a tweet of someone who said, like, if you even remotely think Bitcoin, Bitcoin is an experiment, right? It's either zero or everything. That's always how I saw it. And if you, and then I saw a tweet once that said, if you even think remotely think Bitcoin is not going to be zero, then you should get a seat in the stadium, right? And that's basically when I moved way more in. But now we have this seat in the stadium, right? And we see the fluctuations, as you mentioned. And actually, because we did the work and we are there, we are actually improving also ourselves, like what we just talked about, right? Like you're getting to know yourself because you're looking at these other people that go up, they follow the price, they go up and down, and there's hysteria and the bubble pops a bit, etc. And you're still sitting there on your hands, right? And you're learning to follow yourself. You're learning to trust yourself and the feeling that you, I think, created or manifested in a sense because you did the work, right? So that's, I think, also in part for me, like how it changed me or improved my life, is that I know that I can understand, like, trust myself with my diligence or my, energy that I put into something. So I like that you said that because I think that's a good analogy, right? It's the other people that not understanding what this is yet.
Yeah, and so the weathering the volatility is almost like an emotional gym. Like you go to the gym and there's times when it's really hard, and that's the bear market, or that's the doubt, or the even the FOMO is also challenging. I find often that the euphoria is actually the most difficult period for me, when there's everybody's going crazy and the taxi drivers are all talking about Bitcoin. That's often the most challenging. But so yeah, but I think it's great training, like you say, to like learn to know yourself and grow resilience, to just build more cool stuff for
Irrationality,
the world,
right?
and take care of ourselves. Sorry?
Yeah. Now, like, it's resilience against irrationality, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if people want to get into Bitcoin and study it, right? What is like a very common misconception or misunderstanding that you still encounter, and how do you address it?
Well, the gold bugs are interesting, people who love gold, because a lot of them have known about Bitcoin for 10 years now, and of course there have been gold bugs that have adapted and are now just they own Bitcoin and gold, but there are holdouts who are still very adamant about that Bitcoin cannot work. And so they are a pretty interesting source of objections against Bitcoin, because at least they understand, yes, in order for money to really work, it needs to be scarce. So, at least there's a category of objections that are honestly ridiculous that at least they don't have anymore. But they still really struggle with Bitcoin in, for example, that it's not tangible. That's difficult for them, that you cannot hold a Bitcoin in your hand, which is part of why it's so powerful, of course, because it means you can store it in all kinds of ways that you cannot do with gold, and also that you can verify it much more accurately and rapidly than you can do with gold, which people often don't think about. But if you have a gold coin or a gold bar, you don't know if it's real. It could be coated, it could be tungsten with the coating around it, and then you really need some serious skill to be able to verify if it's real or not. So yeah, like I said, like those guys have some interesting objections. They often struggle also with divisibility, weirdly. They think that the fact that, or not everybody, but there are a few who think that, oh, you can divide Bitcoin into a million pieces, one Bitcoin into a million pieces. That means it's not scarce.
Like the pizza
So
lady.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, and then of course there's doom scenarios that they have about, yeah, what if all the electricity fails on the planet? There's some kind of Carrington event, a big solar flare, and all the electricity falls out. Then what are you going to do? But the fact is that as long as we have one copy of the blockchain, he's even on could be on the surface of the moon or in a satellite somewhere, one copy of the blockchain, and we find a way to store that copy and then later recreate some computers, then we can actually reboot the network no matter when. And of course, once we're in the Stone Age, like I don't know if you'll be able to do a lot with your gold coins either.
I think that the fact that like their counter argument of a solar flare on the scale of probability is very far, it's probably on the other end of the spectrum than, our argument and the probability of what if you want to sell your gold right now to someone in China when you are in the US at 3 a.m. in the night, right? That's a more
Absolutely.
probable
Yeah.
scenario,
Yeah. What if
you
you lived
know?
in Ukraine and war breaks out and you have a kilo of
Exactly.
gold? Are you gonna be able to take it with you across the border?
Yeah,
I
it's
don't know.
nonsense.
Like
No.
we do know a bunch of stories of people who had Bitcoin and actually used it to get out.
Yeah, I liked I don't know if you saw the talk by Jack Mallers at Bitcoin Atlantis.
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Yeah, for me that's one of the best explanations I've seen in 10 years. But he said you can store Bitcoin is stored in your head and gold is stored in your butt, he said. And then he had like this article of someone who tried to smuggle gold,
Oh
right,
yeah.
in the plane. You know, and I think, you know, it's a fun, silly equation, but it's just very true. You know, once you understand kind of like the metaphysical nature of Bitcoin, and you are like, you know, I flew to Thailand a few months ago, and they're like, if you have more than $10,000 equivalent, you know, fill in this form. And I thought, I have more, but you don't know that, right?
And also, it's in the cloud. That you know, was it. You don't have it physically with you. It's stored on the blockchain. You only have the key with you, maybe.
Yeah. Well, yes, maybe. So if you ask me tomorrow and I say no, like, how do you prove it? You know, like, I think this is the entire point. For me, that's the magic in a sense, right? Like, you're the only one who knows if you own it. And like, that is real. That's real sovereignty in a sense.
Well, and I think Jack's way of describing it is actually also, it's not as trivial what he's saying, because he's describing duress scenarios. He's basically saying, if it really comes down to it and you're really under stress, how are you going to store gold versus how are you going to store Bitcoin? And that's always the true test of technology, is will it withstand duress? That's why Bitcoin is so redundant. There's 75,000 nodes around the world. So yeah, it's an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So you mentioned briefly, I think, the article, or well, you mentioned Reformation, but you wrote a paper called The Bitcoin Reformation. And you argue that, you know, Bitcoin is a catalyzer for huge change. I think we just touched upon that, right? Like on our views on money, our views on and how we use money. What drives this? Can you elaborate a little bit on it? Like, why does Bitcoin catalyze this huge change in the world?
Because it challenges the monopoly of the global monetary order. The analogy that I made was that back in the early 1500s, the Catholic Church had a monopoly on, you could call it access to heaven, something like that, like a peaceful afterlife. That was what the church had a monopoly on, a service that it was providing. And the Protestants early on, they did not have a common set of beliefs. The only thing that they thought was, well, why do we need the church to do that? Can we just on our own find other ways to find salvation? And then that meant that they just would stop paying the taxes to Italy. And of course, it's complicated too, because back then, the Catholic Church was instrumental also, I believe, at least via their alliances with Catholic governments, to push the Islamic threat, because there was a lot of warfare happening in the Mediterranean. And of course, you probably know, at some point, Spain got occupied. This is in the early Middle Ages. Spain got almost entirely occupied by the Ottoman Empire. So there is an argument to be made why the Catholics felt like it was so important that they had that power to basically maintain the peace in Europe. But anyway, like the Dutch said, like, hey, like we want to do things differently. And some Germans, of course, and French. And so similarly, now we are subject to a monopoly of the IMF, the, you know, the global financial system, basically, that is working kind of similarly to the Catholic Church. It's a hierarchical system, and there's a lot of separate organizations that are involved in it and that get benefits from it. And in order to get financial salvation, you have to work with the banks. You know, that you are tied to this system. And that means your money is in a bank and they can take it away if they want to. They can inflate it away. There's so much power that they have over your financial life. And Bitcoin is saying, hey, can't we just do this independently? Why do we need you guys? And so in that sense, it's heresy. It is breaking that convention. And that is historic. Yeah. You know, that is a once in a 500-year type event, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love that analogy, right? Or that illustration, the fact that a third party creates an application that you use in your daily life, of which you think, you know, improves your life. but the issuer of the application has the real influence, right? Or the real benefits. Yeah, I think that's great.
They tell you that they're offering you this service, but they keep skimming, they keep taxing you in a way that's invisible. That's the thing that's uncomfortable and wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah. And in the book, you mentioned millennials, I think, as the primary adopters that will drive the reformation, because they will inherit, you know, more wealth from their parents, grandparents, etc. How do you see this progressing now? I think you saw the video of the graduation speech. You know, that generation is probably a bit younger. That's Gen Z. They were booing, which it's interesting. It's an interesting conversation. But how do you see it with regards to millennials? Of course, this is why I started this podcast. But interested to hear.
Interesting, yeah. I believe millennials. I'm part of the oldest slice of the millennials. I believe that if you were 16 years old when 9/11 happened, you are a millennial.
It's between 81 and 96.
Okay.
Ish. Yeah.
Well,
I was 14.
I think we. Of course, Gen Z as well, but we have the privilege of, really the luck that there is some prosperity that we saw in our younger life. Hopefully we were able to build up some savings as well. We are most likely to inherit from the boomers more sooner than the Gen Z generation. And then also we grew up, not everyone, but a bunch of us grew up experiencing things like BitTorrent, for example, where you download music and videos in a completely decentralized way. And that's, I feel pretty certain that that's something that helped me a lot in grasping Bitcoin on a kind of a core level. It's like, oh, it's like BitTorrent, but money. Whereas older people, they don't understand the idea that a technology exists and nobody's in charge. That's weird to them, or especially digital technology. I think we have a lot going for us. And to an extent now, it's harder to build up wealth. Of course, if you're active in the Bitcoin economy, more and more, there's more and more opportunities to do that. But of course, there is going to be some money that's going to be inherited. And I think a lot of the gold bars that people inherit are going to be sold for Bitcoin. I haven't studied it more, especially the difference with Gen Z, for example. I don't feel particularly confident about that, but I do feel the millennials have some extra benefit to the things that they've experienced compared to Gen X, for example.
Yeah. I think how I look at this, I think I had two tweets about gold this week. One was I saw a video of a woman emptying a bag of gold bars, right? And then, you know, talking about also what you just said, you need three machines to verify if it's real, right? How are you going to move this? How are you going to sell this in the middle of the night? All these things, it's just stupid. I could download the song, you know, during my 1 a.m. Internet surfing period, or, you know, when I was 15 and I saw a song, I downloaded it instantly. I got it, right? And I don't know who hosted it. Maybe it's not even anyone in the Netherlands, right? And so I think that experience is interesting, but also the other one, really, I'm going to store value in a shiny rock. You know, the fact that we were on the border of, you know, the physical and the digital world, and we got introduced to this digital world, right? But we still used in our youth stuff from the physical world, right? I think it gives us a great perspective on, I don't know. I just think shiny rocks, you know, it's just, it's weird. It feels so antiquated, right? And it's 2024. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know. I think it's fascinating, but confusing at the same time, right? But for me, gold, I never even looked at gold, right? Even when I found Bitcoin and started getting more into the store value stuff, etc. I never looked at gold because it's just you know, Cleopatra had gold. What are we doing? You know, that's kind of
yeah. And
my feeling.
In some way, we should thank the central bankers because they really promoted the idea that you can store monetary value on a ledger. The only thing we're saying is, why does it have to be your ledger?
Yeah, this is a better ledger. Exactly, right? So you're moving to another system that is controlled by no one. But yeah, I pasted a little a tweet from you in my Notion that I used to prep. But this was you tweeted the gold price, kilo of gold in Bitcoin, I think. Yeah. So you said, this is a market battle of the ages. Once one Bitcoin trades over 10 kilograms of gold, Bitcoin's market cap will have surpassed that of the world's above ground gold stock, right? And one of the things I find super interesting is, you know, if we replace gold as the most valuable asset on earth, you know, when we grew up, we learned, well, to have, you know, you should have gold and you should have silver, right? And if you ever buy like real forks and knives, like cutlery for yourself, it should be like nice silver, you know? And this is like the narrative, right? But we have been above silver. So that narrative was then already destroyed, right? And it's gold, Bitcoin, silver. And once we pass gold, that entire narrative that hundreds of millions of people grew up with is dead. You know, I'm waiting for that day because I think that is really one of the big inflection points also in, yeah, kind of substantiating the value of Bitcoin, right? Like,
yeah,
yes, there is more value. And it's all like, none of it is paper, by the way, right? Which with gold and silver, you know, is still very unclear, right? So I think it solidifies lots of the arguments that we now share.
Yeah, and because I was pretty deeply involved in the gold world before I discovered Bitcoin as a way to think about protecting against inflation. And it really has been kind of where the conservative impulse has been stored in a way, like the investment conservative impulse that most people who have that, they've always had some gold. And I think you're right. I think that people underestimate the psychological power that gold still has in this world. And it's so interesting that the resistance that we're seeing, just price technically, actually in 2021 and 2022, we were very, very close to 1 kilo of gold in Bitcoin. And then we went to it again. And then we went down. And now we're again, even though the dollar price has been higher because gold has gone up as well, we're basically again pushing against the limit of 1 kilo of gold per Bitcoin. And I think it's probably not a coincidence. There is something psychological similar to, there's been dollar barriers as well, where there is resistance at $1 and 10 and 100 and 1,000, because people think like, oh, but Bitcoin cannot be worth more than that. And so once we go above a kilo, then the next target is 10 kilo, which is literally what you're saying, that parity with gold. It means Bitcoin is worth as much as gold once we hit 10 kilo. And I think you're right. If we go above 10 kilo, it's going to be pretty monumental. It's going to, because all the conservative people will then have to deal with Bitcoin. They can no longer say, oh, it's the little brother and who cares? It's like, no, this is bigger than gold now in 20 years or however long it's going to take.
Yeah. Well, you can flip the delusional script on the gold box, right? You know, because then more people trust Bitcoin at that point than gold to store their value, right?
Yeah, I think I'll always have some kind words for gold bugs, no matter if they hate Bitcoin, because they still really care about scarcity and generally, you know, don't spend more than you have and those kind of things. So I don't know. I will always have some sympathy. And of course, you know, there is some merit in general to being a little bit conservative and not just jumping on board of a new train if it's only 15 years old. Like they are right to say gold has been around for 6,000 years. Bitcoin is 15 years old. You know, we need time to, I don't know. I don't judge anyone for waiting.
No, me neither. I, what I just meant with like, you know, shiny rocks, like that is for me. Like I grew up on the internet, right? One side question, when you said like, yes, it's just 15 years old, right? I think if you see the comparison, you know, the table between Bitcoin and gold, right? The only thing which is more negative on the Bitcoin side than gold is like the age, right? They say, you know, and then from age people derive trust then, I'm assuming. Would you say that something like the halving, right, where we basically see or we kind of like celebrate that, you know, the monetary policy of the protocol is still enforced and adopted, right? Because we dropped the block rewards. Would you say that that like repeating event / transparency should actually like speed up the time, if that makes sense, right? It's not 15 years. Like it's something that's added to the quality of Bitcoin, something that we do not have with gold, right? Like the 2% inflation number for gold it's not a scientific number. It's not a proven number, right? Nobody can really check it. And when there's asteroid mining, you know, then that narrative also dies, right? So yeah, I just want to ask your thoughts on that, because for me, that is something that adds to Bitcoin that nothing else has, basically. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it makes sense. That it's so elegant, you know, to have one event every 4 years to cut the inflation in half. Because he could have done it in a different way, that it was more a smooth curve. But I find it, yeah, it's fascinating. It's really elegant, and it's almost so like a global PR event. It advertises that, hey, like, yeah, Bitcoin is just cutting it in half once more. Yeah. We keep trucking. Yeah. It's like the solar eclipse. Like it's predicted, and then it happens. It's like, oh my God, this is real. It's so powerful in that sense. You're right. Gold doesn't have that. And actually, when gold becomes more popular, the inflation goes up because the price goes up. So it's more profitable to mine. And you saw that in the 1850s, there was a valuation boom. And also there was a mining boom in the 1930s because the gold price went up a lot. So yeah, it's kind of the opposite with Bitcoin, where it's so inert. It doesn't care about the price at all. So it's just going to keep doing what it does. Very powerful. Yeah, I agree. It sets it apart.
Yeah. So from like a philosophical standpoint, mm-hmm. how do you look at like the incentives in Bitcoin, game theory you touched upon before, and like how that influences our behavior?
Oh, you mean as with regards to, for example, time preference?
Yeah, exactly. Like how do you see like those elements influence our life?
I think the Austrians just have fantastic methodology there, because people tend to overcomplicate things usually when they think about, oh, economic laws and how this influences that. And it's all very abstract and maybe you need formulas and stuff. But what the Austrians say is that human action has certain laws and incentives that work for the individual, create effects on a global scale, just because and so you can basically imagine situations that are very, very small and easy to put in your mind, like a Robinson Crusoe who's stranded on an island, or just a family living together in a house, and then you change one variable and you look what happens. So it's actually really accurate to say your story or my story, you know, how did Bitcoin change my life? Well, it allowed me to not to appreciate the value of saving my money a lot more than when I was living in a fiat world, where my savings were expressed in euros and they kept lowering in value over time. Because in Bitcoin, every year on average, it goes up however much, like 115% on average or something.
Yeah.
So either you are very much incentivized to wait. You just wait and you cultivate patience, and there's so many implications from that. A low time preference society is a society that builds cathedrals that are built over 200, 300 years. Low time preference society is a society that produces artists like Beethoven and Bach and there is a certain spiritual element as well, I believe, where society tends to appreciate things that are universal and eternal in a more profound way than a society that is always trying to survive. Because tomorrow, who knows, they might steal all our money again. They might do another stimulus that you saw. If you talk to business owners about COVID, it was so disruptive. You know, even the stimulus event was disruptive because then you are chasing the subsidies and you forget about your customers. And it's so confusing. And that's what Mises also says, is that interventionism makes economic calculations so difficult, almost impossible. And the opposite is just a free market with hard money. That is actually when the economic machine does its best work and creates prosperity for everybody. So yeah, I mean, that's something to, you know, you can write books and books about it, but the core element is the time preference change. Like it helps you breathe and think long term.
Yeah. Yeah, you said eternal. I like that. You know, like then I think like fiat money is ephemeral, right? It's fleeting. Yeah. And everything you do with it is fleeting, and all the time you spend on it is fleeting. It's not stored, right? Like I think that's a
well, one thing, for example, that I notice all the time now if I walk around is I see the difference between, like, I went to a little sculpture park and so there were a few sculptures that were made out of stone and others that were made out of like flimsy metal, or not even that, like some kind of other material. And you could already see, after it was 10 years old, this park, and you could already see a bunch of the sculptures were starting to deteriorate. Just that apparently those artists, I don't know if they didn't care or they didn't have the money to actually, you know, create art that would last, you know. And I think you see it in, I'm sure, in Europe as well, with the difference between art that was created in the 1800s that is still beautiful today, and then art that was put there 20 years ago that's already falling apart.
Yeah. Sometimes I go to Belgium, known to you, obviously. And then when I drive around, sometimes I think, when was this nice?
Mm.
You know, when this was made. But I in Belgium, I think, like, I cannot really even see, like, when something was made, right? But sometimes I think, like, when was this nice, right? Is there no one who drives here and thinks, like, maybe we should upgrade this, right? Or, you know, demolish it and put in something new or make it better or whatever, right? Like, it's just, it's very out there, I would say, right? And then, of course, there's places also in Belgium, you know, where there are actual things from 200-400 years ago. I mean, something like Bruges is amazing, right? But yeah, it's so interesting that it's kind of like quality over quantity or something. Also,
well, yeah, I mean, it's also, it just, who gets to be powerful in a fiat world? It's people that have short time preference and who know how to play the political game and how to be close to where the money comes out, where it's being produced. And that's, you know, means you have to be around psychopaths, and it means you have to be in a very toxic environment. So people that have low time preference, even in a fiat world, they will be more private, more entrepreneurial, away from politics. And so, yeah, that's why the taxes, like Millet says, like, it just, there's no limit to how much taxes socialists will want. It's infinite. So that's why the tax pressure in Belgium, I believe it's 52% now. It's like every dollar that's being produced is more than half of it is taxed. And so that's why there's no money to maintain all the beautiful buildings and build new stuff. It's a tragedy. People die from this stuff, you know, because it also goes into healthcare and all kinds of things. That's one of the things that economics taught me is to see the alternative world in your mind's eye, to look at, like you're saying, you're, you know, driving through Belgium as like, what if there was no fiat money 100 years ago and they stayed on a gold standard or hard money somehow? How would this country look like? And it's exactly. Would be night and day. You cannot even imagine the wealth and the beauty, I believe.
Yeah. It's funny when people say, like, you know, if the whole purpose of Bitcoin is to hold it, nothing will ever happen. You know, and my answer to that is always no, you get to live your life also together with other people. It's not a lonely thing, right? Mm-hmm. But you get to live your life. You get the freedom back that is now also spiritually taken from you, right? Like, how can you come up with a new cathedral if you're worried about getting dinner tonight?
Yeah.
You know, like that, even if you're a stonemason, you know, you don't have time for that, literally.
Yeah. And we like to kind of, you know, poo-poo or look down on centuries ago how people lived, and everybody was dirt poor. But in some ways, especially up to the 1500s, there was more stability for people. If you think about the last 100 years, we had two world wars. We had several drastic devaluations that happened. But like, just look at the paintings, you know, like look at Bruegel. Exactly. and Rembrandt and Frans Hals and all those people. Like that was in many ways a beautiful life that people had. It doesn't mean that it wasn't maybe as long as ours, but I don't think it's, you know, I think it might be a little arrogant to just assume we have it better now in a kind of a social sense. Mm.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to ask you two more things before we wrap up.
Yeah.
About global adoption and game theory, do you have any thoughts on like countries or regions that you think would have the greatest potential to adopt Bitcoin or contribute to its development?
Well, if you follow my tweets, you can probably already guess I'm going to at least mention Texas and Argentina. I think, I mean, honestly, I am gradually more impressed by El Salvador as well, although I still don't know if I understand the culture very well. I just don't know how sustainable these changes are, and how, for example, rule of law, I think, is very important and very, very difficult to change once a certain system of courts and juries and lawyers, and once that's put in place, it's very resistant to change. So I'm very bullish on Latin America in general. Although the Americas have the advantage that it's a continent of immigrants, and Europe does not have that advantage. We do have immigrants, but they were not bootstrapped. A lot of them have been attracted by giving subsidies and welfare checks and those kind of things, and that's a different type of person that you attract versus just saying you can come here and make something, but we're not going to give you any money. And that's what, yeah, I think the Americas is. So I think Asia has the challenge of this consensus culture. Like they like to agree on a lot of things, and that can lead to a lot of volatility in times of change. You know, if there's a regime change needed, or there's a big technological revolution that changes a lot of variables, then I think you have the risk of warfare and those kind of things, and populism. So yeah, I'm very, very bullish on the Americas. Of course, Canada is worrisome. I think the US is also tricky. You know, there's a lot of collectivism there too. I think the dollar is, there's, if you think about the federal government, for example, 3 million people are directly employed by the federal government, 15 million contractors apparently, or 12 million, I'm not sure.
Wow.
So that's a lot of people whose paychecks are dependent on the value of the US dollar, and people who could potentially get very angry if there is a change in the monetary system. So yeah, that remains to be seen. And in Europe, I think on the edges, it'll be interesting. You know, there's always little countries, you know, of course, it could be a Switzerland or a Monaco or who knows, maybe a Portugal. I think that these figures that we're now seeing, like a Millet and Bukele, that is just the beginning. Like, we are going to see more and more new political figures that embody the Bitcoin spirit in some way. And of course, in some countries, it'll be just like with the Reformation, you know, some people took the word Protestant and they made something crazy out of it. Like, you know, I honestly, maybe people will be offended by this, but I think in Germany, for example, the Protestantism was pretty extreme there. So they kind of, instead of saying, oh, we embrace freedom of religion, they say, no, we have a new system and a new monopoly, and this is how it is. So I definitely don't want to say a blank check for all the future presidents who are pro Bitcoin. Like, some of them are going to be crazy, but at least there is going to be a Bitcoin vote, I believe, that is going to shake things up.
Well, and I think also two episodes back, if you didn't see it, check it out. I have Maya Parbu. She's going to be a presidential candidate in Suriname in May 2025.
Again, like Africa as well, you know, Africa could make an enormous leap because they have been financially enslaved for such a long time.
Suriname is South America.
Suriname?
Above Brazil.
Suriname. Wait, why am I so confused? That's very embarrassing because you're right, next to Guyana. I see.
But we talked about I talked about it with her, and I said, you know, I think you have more than a nation behind you, right? I think that is so interesting that this, you know, you are probably known with the Balaji network state idea, right? Bitcoin is a network state in that sense. So anything that she would share that is interesting, like, it's going to be super amplified versus, you know, I don't know, the random opponent that she will have, you know, that is totally not into Bitcoin. So I think that's going to be just super interesting.
The history of the United States, where the places that were friendly to the crazy duchies who just wanted to trade, you know, and who maybe not, because there were some very religious colonies in the early days, very, you know, very specific religious colonies, and those became less prosperous than, for example, New Amsterdam, where it was just about trade and freedom. And so I think similarly in Latin America, just remains to be seen, like, wherever freedom is welcome, that's where the money and the economic opportunities is going to flow towards.
Yeah,
and I mean, 100%. I do think there's an element too with energy, where countries that have a lot of untapped stranded energy, they will, of course, love to get involved with mining.
Yeah, I agree. I think Suriname ticks a lot of boxes, actually, also with this energy part. But also, I thought there were more people, but it's only 600,000 people, but the country is huge. Right. So it's not that many people to convince, actually.
Sure.
Right?
Iceland is 300,000. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
A small countries can be surprisingly fast in changing things and making things happen. I was confusing it with Senegal. That's why I was so confused.
Oh, yeah. So I think, you argued a lot. Also, currently, you know, Bitcoin is very undervalued considering how you see it as, like, a long-term store of value. Where do you see Bitcoin going in the next 5-10 years in terms of price, if you want to say price, but like adoption, overall impact?
Yeah, I think that we are now finally in the 1995 moment, if you compare Bitcoin to the internet adoption. 1995, Bitcoin internet adoption was around 9% in the US, and I think that's about where Bitcoin is, probably, at least in developing countries, but developed countries, but maybe even globally, that people are really starting to have some exposure to Bitcoin. And so that means, I think from here we'll accelerate. There'll be more and more on-ramps. Like the ETF is like, that is like the Windows 1995 operating system. It just, you know, you just push a button and you go online. So I think this cycle is huge. And even within this cycle, I think we could go above $200,000. We could go as high as $600,000. So that means for the next 2-3 years, basically. And then after, I do think, like I said, I think governments feel very threatened. And so there's going to be backlash. So things are going to get interesting. maybe we'll have countries that try to make central banks of Bitcoin. They'll like take an exchange and nationalize it or something like that. So that's why I always caution people to try and store your own Bitcoin and not just go ahead with these ETFs and stuff, because that's the low hanging fruit. Like that's very easy to dominate. I'm very, very bullish for the Bitcoin price. This is just the early days of a new bull market, I think.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned before, you know, like we are in a 1 in 500 year paradigm shift, and it's something I share a lot with people, that the fact that we are living in that moment is so mind-blowing, actually, that you just dismiss it, right? But I think we should keep repeating that we are actually there and that you can participate. Although the finance guys have figured it out, you know, you can still participate. And yeah, it's just, it's going to be fascinating to see where it goes. And I think, you know, we have our seats in the stadium. This is kind of how I see it, right? Like we have the seats in the stadium and we're watching. And for me, it kind of became like entertaining, because I know what I know, right? And there are some unknown unknowns, right? You never know what governments could do, you know, or the examples that you give. But I know that I'm sitting there solidly, you know, and it's just, it's actually, I'm totally captivated by it, right? Like this is what I think about every day, and it's entertaining. Like I want to see this, right? And the, like all the memes of, you know, the most entertaining outcome is the most likely. Like I believe that, you know, like we're gonna see that. And even when we have a drawdown after this bull run, like it's gonna be a bigger group of people that understand what that is, and it's you know, it's growing person by person. And so
yeah, it's just better technology. Yeah, that's why it's going to get adopted
about
it's
the future.
Just, it's just better. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, like do you want to stick with horses or, you know, swords instead of gunpowder? Like what are you talking about? And also that I think is a good way to put that, you know, 1 in 500 year paradigm thing in perspective. Like I think the gunpowder example is great, because you know, everyone understands that, right? Okay, so you have swords, I adopt gunpowder. What do you think is going to happen? You know, and like, yeah, well, I hope that triggers enough people. I want to be mindful of your time, but I want to ask you my last question that I ask everyone. And that's, what's a core belief that you will never let go?
Wow. Well, on the verge of, the first thing that came to mind is just believing that the truth is real. Like the truth is out there, and we can, it's like the X-Files, the truth is out there. But no, that we can actually identify truth as human beings, and if we work at it, we can actually surprisingly learn a lot of things about the world and about ourselves, and that is to me really the catalyst of so much optimism and hope, because it also means if the truth is real, then it's something universal, and then we can all connect to that and then connect to each other via that means. So we don't have to be isolated and living in our own delusions. We can actually, just all be connected and collaborate and make this into a wonderful existence. That was the first thing that came to mind.
Love that. I think that's a perfect ending.
Well, wait, before thanks, you man, close, thanks. Can I just say, I think you're a really great host. I think you ask great questions, and it's very obvious that you are very well versed in the Bitcoin, universe. And so I think you do your listeners a great service. I'm definitely going to check out some of your content.
Thanks so much. Like I don't think you know what that means for me, but I think I really, really appreciate that. And man, I want to thank you for your time, and maybe we can do this again in the future. And let's stay in touch. I'll make sure to link to your profiles and stuff so people can follow you. And thanks again.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.